It's Thursday. It's the Gab and Jules show. And today, Jules, we're going to talk about Diego Maradona. We're going to start at the top of the show. We'll have Champions League. We'll get to all that. But, you know, it's a sad day. And it's a kind of, it is one of those, you know, where were you type moments of Diego's passing. We'd reported before he'd been unwell. Yeah. But then it sounded as if he was getting better. And I never really conceived that it would happen. He's 60 years old.
I thought he was immortal. And I really believe legends never die, of course. And his legacy, his talent will live forever. But I just thought he was never die. You know, I really thought he was immortal, that nothing could destruct him, not even himself. And yet it happened. The greatest of all time for me, you know, of course there's a debate. I just think he was blessed by the gods. He was also blessed by the demons. He had that dark side of him, of course.
Well, one of the great lines that's been said about him, which I quoted in my piece, was, you know, for somebody who rose so high that he touched the stars, he also spent a lot of time in the gutter.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big part of his appeal, the fact that he had these weaknesses. And, you know, it's funny, I mean, not to get too deep about this, but so many of these stars have their weaknesses, right? We know these heroes have weaknesses, maybe not to the same degree, maybe not to the same, you know, level of Diego Maradona. You know, you don't have to go and bother George Best or Sid Vicious or whatever about this, right? But Maradona's were lived out in public. And I think that is, you know, that was so in your face. That was so evident, yeah. So obvious.
But because of his status, because he went beyond football. You know, we're talking Michael Jordan and Muhammad Ali territory here. There's not many sportsmen who've reached the level that he reached in terms of celebrity all around the world. For people even who didn't like football or didn't watch it, you know, he was that big because of his footballing genius, but like you said, because of all his personality, all his demons, all the controversy.
I think in terms of the celebrity side, he's there with Michael Jordan, Muhammad Ali, and probably Pelé. I think where he's different, at least from Pelé and Michael Jordan, is his outspokenness, his willingness to stand up to the establishment.
Yeah, of course.
His willingness to speak out on often on deeply unpopular political issues. That kind of gives him another dimension. And look, for me personally, I don't think he always spoke intelligently on those issues, unlike Muhammad Ali. I mean, that's what makes him different. But he had the guts to do that. He had the cojones to go out and talk about it. He had this anti-establishment streak. And I think that is a huge part of his appeal. You know, we both live in London, England, right? So 1986, the hand of God. The part of the reason that resonated, part of the reason there's people out there who understand that when he says it was the hand of God, he's not lying, he's not cheating, he's making a metaphor. It was the hand of God. And to the rest of the world, what they saw on that day, they saw somebody, for better or worse, from the developing world, from the outside, going up against the team that represents the establishment when it comes to football, the people who invented the game, who codified the game, the people who you know, didn't bother showing up for the first three World Cups because it was beneath them, right? The people who had the empire. It was on the background of a few years after the Malvinas as well.
They were the enemies.
Yeah, that is what people saw. And that has an appeal, you know?
Yeah, completely.
You had the benefit. I mean, I came across him twice. I'm not going to lie. I can't pretend to know him. I know a lot of people played with him. A lot of people can talk about the significance of him at Napoli and elsewhere. But you came across him personally in Marseille. You got to spend some time with him.
Yeah, I interviewed him, not on my own. I don't think I could have it anyway, interviewed him on my own. I mean, I didn't ask a question. There was five of us, five journalists in Marseille before the France-Argentina friendly game in February 2009, where he was the national team head coach, of course. And he was just, for me, and he was God. And the way his behavior, his charisma, his aura, he was God. I mean,
by the way, use the word God there. For me personally, as a Christian, it's a bit loose.
No, but you know what I mean?
The headline in L'Équipe today.
Yeah.
It's full on Nietzsche. God is dead.
The front page, yeah. But when I meant God, of course.
No, of course, yeah.
But there was, there was all those scenes that I can vividly remember in the hotel when they were going for lunch and dinner. All the players had to wait for him to arrive and wait at the door, and one after the other they would arrive and they were waiting and would walk in and just kiss him and then go into the lunch room or the dinner room or whatever, and until he was there you could not get in, and he was there with his cigar, and then they were all queue, and we're talking, you know, we're talking Messi and Mascherano and Aguero and all those players, and then they would walk in and kiss him on the cheek like if he was their father or something else. And then the scenes of training where at the age of 48, with his cigar in his mouth, he was still hitting free kicks in the top corners for 5 minutes. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
I mean, there's a level to that charisma, that resonance around the world, which is remarkable. To me, the other thing that stands out is at times he was divisive, he was controversial. He said, I think, a lot of pretty nasty things about a number of people, but there's a redemption side to it. And in this, again, is very similar to Muhammad Ali. Towards the end of his career, or really in the last 15, 20 years, he made up with everybody he fell out with. From Pelé, you know, he had some very unpleasant, horrible things to say about Pelé. But he took everybody back in the world. Daniel Passarella, who's probably the only teammate he ever had with whom he fell out with while he was a teammate. Because this is the other thing about him. His teammates, the people who were with him every single day, adored him. And you know, that is the appeal of Diego, right? The genius and the humanity rolled into one. And I think what felt like a certain, Manu Chao might disagree, but a certain accessibility.
Yeah,
you know,
completely.
The fact that we can see the human in them. And, you know, for me, this is a tremendous loss. And as I wrote, I can imagine one day somebody coming along, I'm being like Pelé, only better. Somebody coming along and being like Messi, only better. Like Cristiano, only better.
Yeah.
Like Diego, maybe even bettering what he did on the pitch, but never off the pitch. Never the whole package.
Yeah,
you know, there will never be another. Podcast listeners, you're still with us. Obviously, Jules, we could do a whole 50-part series on this. But we want to talk a little bit more about Napoli, about the national team. But I want to go back to something else at the very beginning. I had the opportunity to, years ago, I went to Argentina and I spent time with a guy named Jorge Sister Spieler, who was his first agent.
Yeah.
Now.
So, and Diego was the first player really to have an agent. It was not really common before him.
Yeah, it was pretty much unknown, and this is the most remarkable thing. So first of all, was how the two of them, how Jorge Sister Spieler and Maradona got together. So Jorge Sister Spieler, who, I mean, later on, I mean, he was still a big guy, but I saw a picture. If you can look him up, he's a fat kid who's got some kind of, I think he had polio. So he's walking with a limp and a cane. He's got, you know, enormous big hair like Diego did at the time. He's only 3 years older than Diego. And he had a brother who played for Argentinos Juniors. And because of that, because Jorge was, you know, because he had polio, Argentinos used to let him come and sit by the side of the pitch and take water to the players and stuff and kind of almost be like an unofficial mascot.
Yeah.
So he meets Diego when, I might get the dates wrong, but he's 2 years older than Diego. So he meets Diego, I think, when Diego's 13 and he's 15. And because Diego has to take two buses to get to the training facility, and Sister Spieler, you know, lives across the street from the stadium, Diego starts sleeping in his house. And they form this incredible friendship. But the amazing part, when you mentioned it was his first agent, at some point, I think it was the year before he moved to Boca Juniors, Sister Spieler says, well, I'm your agent. We need to sign a big sponsorship deal. And he somehow, because there's all this buzz about Diego at the time, you know, remember Argentina won the under 20 World Cup
with him,
in Japan
in 77.
That's right. Ramon Diaz, Maradona, and Alonso. And he somehow manages to get in touch with Coca-Cola. And he ends up signing the first global seven-figure sponsorship. But the remarkable thing, as Jorge tells it, is he's on the phone with these people, and they arrange to go to Atlanta, to go to Coca-Cola HQ, to go negotiate with him. These guys, obviously, they obviously know Maradona's 19. What they have no idea is that Jorge's 21. And because he only spoke to them on the phone. And then they get there, and they're like, who's this? You know, there's this fat kid with a cane. I mean, it looks like, I mean, I think Seth Rogen would probably play him in a film.
Yeah.
And it was, and that was Diego. And they get in the room with all these, you know, executives, and they totally hold their own. And that, too, was Diego at 19 realizing that, realizing the difference that he made. And there's so much you could go into. People know about world record move when he moved to Napoli.
Yeah, even to Barcelona.
That was a world record move as well.
Of course, yeah.
You know, it was, I think it was about four times the world record at the time when he moved to Barcelona, let alone what it would become when he moved to Napoli. But of course, it was in Naples that he formed this incredible relationship with the city. And as you know, as anybody who's, you know, there's just two great documentaries about him. One of them is the Maradona by Kusturica, where, you know, he had some access and stuff. There's a remarkable scene in that, and it's on YouTube, and I invite you to go and check this out, where, you know, there's a song called La Mano de Dios by this Argentine singer Rodrigo, which is about Maradona.
Yeah.
And there's this incredible scene where he's in a bar with his friends and his family, and he goes and he sings the song on stage. And he sings a song, but he's singing about himself. So he changes all the words. You know, the words are like, you know, he was born and blah, blah, blah. He says, I was born. And it's truly remarkable and surreal. And the people the people around him, the way interact with him. Obviously, Asif Kapadia's film Maradona, I think more people have seen that.
It's amazing as well, yeah. But you realize when you watch that as well, because he had, you know, he was in the excess, and there was no boundaries for him, and all those demons that we mentioned. But you realize a bit more what a circus he was around him, and how difficult, even if he'd wanted to live a normal life, how impossible that would have been anyway. He was far too adored in Naples. In the documentary, you see that he has to leave with the curtains closed, and, you know, all the windows closed and the shutters closed and all of that, because he could not go out. You know, it was crazy. And I just think in the end, you understand maybe a bit more why he lived the life that he did, maybe why the drugs were a way to escape from all that pressure, you know, expectations.
You had this contradiction where, because look, I mean, Cristiano and Leo Messi would get mobbed on the streets. I think the difference is they choose, probably also because it makes them better professionals, to lead a life away. So, like, you know, Cristiano now lives in this development outside Turin.
Yeah, but it was the 80s as well.
No.
It's not like the 80s.
But you could have done that. You could have done that in the 80s. Diego chose to live in town in Naples. And he had this thing where he needed that separation, but he also wanted to be a part of things. I mean, one incredible story I was told, which I don't think I've told before, is he decided at one point to take up golf. And he had befriended, obviously everybody in Naples was his friend, right? So I think it was the mayor and the chief of police in the small town near the airport in Naples where there was a golf course. But obviously the problem is, you know, you try to go there to play golf and then suddenly word gets around and there's thousands of people showing up, trampling, right? So he would go there and he would play golf at night. 2-3 in the morning when it was dark, and these guys, they basically round up all the municipal vehicles, you know, from the cop cars to the school bus to the sanitation trucks, and they would go and they would drive them on the course and light up the course so that Diego could play.
That's amazing.
You know, you start to see things in a different vein here.
Yeah. And the warm up, the iconic warm up against Bayern Munich in the UEFA Cup 89 semi-final, which obviously we all know, you know, the life is life. We mentioned it on the pod before, on the show.
I wrote a whole piece about the background to that.
I retweeted it yesterday, but he looked even more dramatic in a way now that he's gone, to watch it again. And Nicola Tagliafico, the Argentine left back at Ajax, so to pay tribute to Diego, did it a little bit during the warm-up yesterday before the Michelin game, and I just think that...
He's still Tagliafico. Like.
Yeah, but no, but you know what I mean? I think it's more, you get the
no,
idea.
No, I know.
You know, and it's just those moments that all of us will have of either a goal that you saw, whether you were there or you watched on television or later on, or those images that I think will stay... We stay with you forever. Michel Platini had this sentence one day. He said, "What Zidane could do with a football, Diego could do it with an orange." And it was not disrespecting Zizou, of course, but it was just to show like there's all those great players with amazing talent, of course. And Platini said, "Johan Cruyff for me was the greatest. We all have our greatest, but certainly, I think no one technically could touch." Could touch Diego, not even Messi, not even Zidane, not even Cruyff or Pelé. No one, I think, had this technical ability that he has.
I think in addition to technical ability is also the personality to elevate. Mm. And obviously people know that when he came to Naples, you know, in Italy there's a footballing north-south divide and a social north-south divide. You know, Naples at the time, especially at the time, was an impoverished city. They had a lot of problems. He leaves Barcelona. To go where? To go to Naples. Not to go to one of the big northern teams at the time when Serie A was, you know, by some distance the best league in the world. But he decides to go to Naples. And I remember people having all sorts of doubts. You know, well, why is he coming here? Where's the money coming from to pay him? Why would he want to do this? His first season, he does well, but the team's disappointing. And, you know, it looks like it's all going to end badly. And then he delivers two Serie A titles.
And the first one especially, the second one when Carreca and Alemão, it's a really good team. A good team. The first title, it's a bunch of average players that he elevates and takes to the top.
It's not the same thing. I mean, Ciro Ferrara might disagree a little bit.
Yeah, but
yeah, I take your point. You know, it is he takes them to the top, and he does it. You know, you go back and you look. Who was playing for Juventus, Inter, and Milan at the time? Put it in the context of this of the historical significance that, you know, I think it's like 95% of the Serie A titles in Italy have been won by teams north of Rome, and you understand this was the first title ever for the South. Mm. I think he probably would have won a third one in the year that Milan made that astounding comeback. And, there's still question marks about what happened and how did it happen. And, you know, and that is part of the genius, that is part of the narrative of the dark side. Everybody focuses in 86, the goal against England. You could argue that the goals against Belgium were even better. Again, this is all on YouTube. Check it out. For me, on an international level, the other moment that stands out is from the 1990 World Cup, and it's when they played Brazil. When he does this reverse no look pass with his weaker right foot to set up Caniggia, and it finishes 1-0.
How did you feel in the final when the Romans booed and whistled the anthem, and you see him crying before the game and saying the hijo de, you know, those words, and you clearly read them? Did you?
So it wasn't the Romans, because if you recall, you're talking about
the fans in Rome.
No, it wasn't in Rome. That's the thing. It was the semifinals of the 1990 World Cup. And back then, you know, today, if you're the host, Italy were hosting the World Cup. Back then, if you were the, today, if you're the host nation, you end up generally playing the whole tournament in one city, right? Back then, for whatever reason, Italy, the way it was set up, the semifinal was played in Naples. And as luck would have it, Italy had to play Argentina in the semifinals. And Diego brilliantly went and he stoked the fire. I mean, the reason he's such a leader is he came out and he said to the people in Naples, he said,
"Pick me or something."
Yeah, this is my city. Like, these other people in Italy, they don't care about you. You're the butt of all the jokes in Italy. You know, it's people have made the analogy with Liverpool and Scousers. Yeah. And I think it's a perfectly apt analogy. The way they get treated by sort of the wealthier parts of the country is very similar to what Naples. And Diego rode that to a T. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with people who played in that game, like Gianluca Vialli and others, and explaining during the anthems, because it's the World Cup, obviously not while the game was in Naples, you had a lot of Neapolitans there, but you had a lot of people coming there from other parts of Italy, Italy fans. And he described sort of the tension in the stadium, you know, the Neapolitan fans had, you know, Diego's in our hearts, but we will sing for Italy. other people were frankly offended by what he said, and so they started booing the anthems. You can see him mouthing some very nasty words. But even the atmosphere in the crowd, I mean, I think Luca described it, it felt like you're playing underwater. You know, there's, whereas when they played in Rome, it was raucous, over the top. It's not the reason they lost that game. I mean, nobody understands how it happened, with Walter Zenga coming on, Claudio Caniggia's header, and then the penalties, whatever. But that run to the final, that was Diego, one man willing his team on his shoulders to the final. We had Jurgen Klinsmann on the show last night, who of course played in the final, and I think he converted the penalty in the final.
Andreas Bremer, I think.
Oh, sorry, it was Andy Bremer. Yeah, no. But did he win the penalty? Maybe. Was it Monzon on Klinsmann, which was never a foul?
But
it was Monzon on somebody anyway.
Maybe even on Bremer actually. But yeah,
I didn't realize Bremer could jump that high. But anyway, the final. He talked about how, you know, he said we were man marking him and we were deputized, and whenever he got near the ball, we kicked him. That's what we did. And at that point, remember, throughout the tournament, Diego had railed against FIFA, corruption, blah, blah, blah. You know, in Diego's mind, he created this thing, the whole world is against us, they won't let us win the World Cup, right? And he sold that narrative. I don't know if it's true or not. It was a different FIFA back then. It was a different world. But, you know, you look at him losing that final in those circumstances against that Germany side, and you realize why it resonates. And the same... And then the story could have been the ultimate comeback story. You remember 1994?
Of course, yeah.
You know, this is after that, later he would get banned for cocaine, he'd go to Seville. 1994, they go to the World Cup, and they had that incredible front line. Remember Maradona, Batistuta, Abel Balbo, I think it was. And
Diego Simeone in midfield, they had an amazing team.
Caniggia, was it Redondo too?
Yeah, Redondo as well.
And he scores that was a 3-0 against Romania. I'm going from memory here, and that incredible celebration, and then the positive test, and it's a positive test for pseudoephedrine, which is in,
and it's very thin traces, isn't it? If you're positive, you're positive.
If you're positive. But what I'm saying is, most of us have pseudoephedrine in the form of cough medicine in our medicine cabinets at home. I have no idea what it was. I don't know the story, but. You know, the highs, the lows, there was just so much life wrapped up in this guy, which is just...
And even if you think about 78, just to finish on World Cups and his story with World Cups, he was very young, of course, but...
He was the last man dropped for that World Cup.
Exactly. Yeah. And he could have played with Campes and win that World Cup as well on home soil. I don't know if he would have played a big part of it or not or whatever, and he was a very... It was a special time, and of course, with everything that was happening in the country too, but he could have had 3 World Cups easily, like Pelé.
No, I think he could have had 4. In a different lifetime. 78, obviously, would have been part of the team. You know, would have been very young, but he would have won that. Yeah. 82, it wasn't going to happen. They were in a group with Italy and Brazil. Not going to happen. 86, obviously, he did win. 1990, in a fair universe, they ended up losing 1-0 on a dodgy penalty. Could have won that. Yeah. 94, he doesn't get banned. They win that.
Who knows? Yeah.
Maybe. And then he's got 4 World Cups. And, you know, that is the parallel Dieguista.
Exactly.
The Dieguista line. I feel, I know we're around, I mean, I feel like I'm forgetting stuff.
We could talk about it
because
forever.
We could go on. We could go on forever. But, you know, I think most of all, what strikes me, like I said, is this incredible humanity, this incredible charisma that he had, and the way, and I'm repeating myself, but I think it's worth mentioning, like Muhammad Ali, that arc that he went on where, I mean, not to the degree of Muhammad Ali, obviously he never went to prison, but although he was arrested, as we know, and, you know, but the fact that in the end, his personality and his humanity, you know, makes him popular with everybody. And I really pity the people who don't get it.
Yeah, me too.
I pity the people who, you know, headline, all they could do is headline the hand of goggle, as if, like, this is all that's happened here.
And in the end, I think the biggest tribute, and it's not what we can say on shows or the newspapers, and it's all great, but I think it's the wave of the shock all around the world and the reaction of people. And that's where you see, okay, this was a different level.
Yeah. Final thought on this, The joke in Argentina is that their holy trinity was always Carlos Gardel, Eva Perón,
yeah,
and Diego Maradona. And then maybe when Pope Francis came along, he kind of made it a foursome. But, you know, you look at this, his funeral is coming up. They expect
three days of mourning.
Yeah, they expect more than a million people. I think it's a Fela Kuti-size funeral here that we're heading for. You know, we had our colleague Ricardo Ortiz from ESPN Argentina. And, you know, he said Diego surpasses all of them, hands down, no question. So, you know, that gives you some scope, I think, of what we've lost today.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The Champions League, of course, was back, and Jules, Inter, Conte. We set this up, Inter against Real Madrid. Yeah. Both of them had coming from, you know, rough periods for Conte and his old buddy Zinedine Zidane, and, you know, something's got to give, and Real Madrid take the pitch without Sergio Ramos, supposedly Mr. Everything, without Karim Benzema, the only guy who can score. Now, Inter still managed to screw it up.
They just shoot themselves in the foot all the time. And, you know, we go back to what Lukaku said the other day,
even
that you mentioned on the show. Even as I scored, and when Lukaku said, we're not a great team yet. And I think Wednesday night was another proof of that. You can't be a great team and shoot yourself in the foot like they keep doing. And especially in those big games, you know, the Hakimi back pass in the reverse fixture when they lost at the Di Stefano Stadium. And again, the penalty that Barrera gives away to start with so early in the game, that just ruins all your game plan, ruins all the tactic that you wanted to use, everything, because you're clumsy, maybe you're too eager, maybe too much energy, and you give away that penalty. And after that, it's already a different game.
You know, my problem with the we're not a great team yet is I can buy that. And look, I've been saying this for years, right? I think teams, many clubs, some clubs are different. Many clubs overrate older players. They overrate, the value of experience and blah, 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 and being a winner and whatever, right? They overrate them relative to how much they cost. I've made the point about Arsenal many times. Yeah. I've made the point about Juventus. I think Inter are the epitome of this. You can't say we're not a great team yet when, you know, tomorrow may never come, because look around you, right? Ashley Young is, what, 33, 34? Alexis Sanchez ain't getting any younger. Mm. Arturito Vidal ain't getting any younger. This is it. This is now. The future is now, right now.
Yeah,
right now is when you need to deliver.
I know, but you can't make mistakes. You will never deliver if you keep making those mistakes. I mean, you know, there's a point where you have to think more with your head than just, okay, this is what we have to do. This is the plan. Let's go and do the plan. Doesn't work like this.
But what's frustrating here, and I don't want to dump everything on Antonio Conte, but, you know, I'm sorry, there's a transitive property that applies here. First of all, let me ask you this, sir. If Arturo Vidal does not get sent off, do Inter win this game?
I think they have a chance to winning the game.
Yeah, of course they have a chance. Win it?
I think they win it. The way they reacted after the goal, I think, showed that they certainly had enough to beat this Real Madrid side.
I thought they had a good spell with 10 men early in the second half.
Yeah, but even before the red card, this is a penalty, right? Do you think it's a penalty? Varane on, not so much Modric on Vidal, but Varane on Vidal looks like this could have been given.
It's one of those given. But you need more than that.
Of course you do, but then it's hard to judge the performance now being 10 men from the last hour. I just don't understand how Arturo Vidal, and there's a point where, like you said, you buy experience. In Arturo Vidal, you buy the hot head. And the hot head is stronger than the experience. And all that experience is pointless because you know that anytime it could just kick off and get sent off in the way it did, that would cost you the place in the last 16.
Yeah, I'm all for aggression and rage if it's channeled. The great ones channel it. Mm. Arturo Vidal is just a loose cannon in that sense. He doesn't channel it. Antonio Conte, for all his failings, when he was a player, he channeled it. He very rarely lost control. He was nasty and mean when he needed to be, but he very rarely lost it. Now you bring in a guy who is a ticking time bomb, who's costing you an enormous amount of money and wages. You build a whole team about it. You said, go to war with Arturito. That's great. But now he's in there, and he ended up costing you this game. And I'm sorry, it goes back to Conte. Inter gave Conte a huge contract. He's one of the highest paid managers
in
the world.
You can't even sack him. It'll cost you too much.
They can't sack him. Yeah, this is his second season. And what gets me is when you talk about the silly mistakes, this is Mr. Attention to Detail, right? I mean, the stereotype of Conte, and he's proven this in the past, is twofold, right? One is the passion, the guts, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, then again, what manager isn't about passion and guts, right? Yeah. What manager is like, oh, no, I like my people to be calm and stuff. You know, everybody, right? That's par for the course. The other thing was the attention to detail, the work that they do, the tactics and movement and stuff like that, and everybody knows their role. Mm. And then you make mistakes like that. Barella's out of position.
It's crazy. You know? For me, it's a game that Inter lost more than Real won, although they were very good. Toni Kroos, I thought, was amazing. He saw the deep midfielder role with Odegaard and Modric ahead of him, but it's 10 men against 11 as well. So, of course, you're more comfortable on the ball when you're 11v10. But for Conte and Inter, I think it's such a real shame for someone like Lukaku, for example, if he misses out on Champions League knockout stages.
Word on Real Madrid at this stage, obviously we've had. Is there a takeaway from Zidane from this? Is this a chance for him to teach guys, Benzema and Ramos are great, but we can do it without them too?
Yeah, I think that would be good for him and for the squad. And you saw Nacho, I mean, playing at times like I never saw him play, and it was like, okay.
Nacho's a good,
he's a really good defender. But you still think that Zidane has that luck that pops up for him now and again in the crucial moments that he's thinking like, okay, right, he's got that with him.
Okay, enough of you being anti-French.
No, I love it, but you know, clearly.
All right, I've been very critical of Varane for a while now. Did we see something better, or is it still bad Varane because you nearly gave away a penalty?
No, well, yeah, I thought that was very clumsy from him. But apart from that, and again, let's not forget 11 against 10 for an hour, blah, blah, blah. But against Lukaku, what a hell of a battle that was. And he won it, for sure. And I think he had a bad period. He went with the national team this month, was really good. And I think that helped him massively.
Joe, sticking with Real Madrid, and the age-old thing, the age-old excuse, no Eden Hazard not fit. How did he look to you?
I thought he played really well, I have to say. He scored the penalty, obviously, which was crucial for him. Hadn't scored in the Champions League for 3 years, which is a long time. And you know, he was a bit hit and miss at Chelsea in the Champions League, even with Lille, you know, I guess, when he played there. And it's just good, I think, to see him back at this kind of level if he can stay fit. Even though his relationship with Mariano Diaz wasn't too bad, not as good as with Benzema, and obviously we're talking about Mariano there.
Mariano.
But overall, I thought they needed him.
Sorry, can I still check out my Mariano stat?
What is it?
Mariano played, I think, 86 minutes or whatever it was.
Oh, yeah.
At the weekend, which is more minutes than he's played in like the last 10 months for Real Madrid. Even though, I think he scored, what, 7 goals last season? Like, Mariano's goals to minutes.
In fact, it was brilliant. But yeah, and it's good for Real Madrid to have him back like this. Again, let's hope he stays fit. But again, I just thought that Inter would defend better on him, and maybe the fact that they were down to 10 men was, you know, helped him a lot, I guess.
The thing about Hazard, it's funny, I was thinking about this, you know, you go back, what, 4 years, 3 years, Pochettino in his pomp, Hazard in his pomp. You got two phenomenal players, you know, helping to carry their teams, their London teams, Eriksen and Hazard. Hazard obviously injured forever now, slowly coming back. Eriksen not.
Do you really understand that it would be soon a year since he joined. They spend a lot of money, you know, for someone who was six months
away from free agency.
His contract. Like, it's hard to understand, right? And if you were here, if you were in his boots, you would be like, what happened there? What went wrong?
I don't think there's any excuses here. I know that some people love peddling the line that, well, you know, but Conte didn't want Eriksen. He wanted, you know, I don't care what Conte wanted. Conte signed off on Eriksen.
Yeah.
There's nobody in the world who will persuade me that, I mean, as horrendously run as Inter have been historically, and this really is one of the worst basket cases of a club,
yeah.
I am 100% certain that they would not have signed Eriksen without Conte saying, this is what we need. And this is what they needed. They needed that creativity. You need that match winner. So then does it mean that Conte didn't realize, you know, what Eriksen's strengths are? I think Eriksen's been dealt a raw deal from day one. Because Eriksen looks the way he looks, because his demeanor is the way it is, Conte just either says, well, he either doesn't care or whatever. He plods around the pitch. But, you know, it's up to you to make it work. You know that Eriksen can perform. You know that Eriksen can work hard. You saw it happen with Pochettino. Am I to conclude, Antonio, that Pochettino's a better manager than you are?
Or maybe a better man manager?
Maybe a better person? I don't know.
It's just a shame because then it's to the detriment of your team.
Yeah, and then you're going to take a massive hit because obviously Eriksen's on big wages.
Yeah.
And so that means that you either have to give him away or loan him, assuming you don't change managers.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. Did somebody come down from Mount Olympus with like the words written in lightning saying that Inter have to play three at the back, that Inter have to play 3-5-2?
No, but this is the system that Conte knows the best, right? Knows the most. That's what he was really successful with.
Well, but he's played different systems before. He played a diamond at Juventus. He played. He's done different. He used to play 4-2-4 earlier in his career.
But then don't you think that when you buy the profiles that you need for that system to play with a back three, it's hard now to sort of backpedal a bit and say, okay, let's play 4-4-2 because that's the only other system they can play, right? Whether it's a diamond or flat 4-4-2.
You can't drop Lautaro
or Lukaku, right? So you have to go two up front.
Yeah, you have to go two up front or 1+1 up front. That's fine. I've heard this system. I've heard this notion, right, about that, you know, the only buddy bought people for this system. Apart from Ashraf Hakimi, who else is bought specifically for this system? Surely not Perisic, right?
No,
this is not
Perisic.
A Perisic system, right? Ashley Young didn't really play a back three at all until...
No, but at his age now, he's better in that role than a pure left-back position, right?
I don't know. I mean, unless he does what he did at the weekend when he just went and kicked the guy in the chest because he didn't see him, I think... You know, but look,
then you play three in midfield, and then you can play Barella, Sensi, and Vidal, for example.
How about you don't play Vidal at all?
Yeah, okay.
But this is what I would do, right? Honestly, this is an idea, Inter. It's a good idea, I think, right? You should diversify your business from football into perhaps cage fighting.
UFC.
Put Vidal and Raja Nainggolan, who's also right?
Yeah.
Put them in a cage on top of the San Siro, charge pay-per-view, leave those guys there. I don't want to see this. I mean, I'm not having a go.
Is Raja Nainggolan still an Inter player?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it, right? All right, I'm being a bit harsh, but I don't need to see this. I don't need to see this.
You
have about 11 midfielders. Vecino's still an Inter player somewhere.
God, that is a hell of a club.
Borja Valero, however, is gone, at least
one.
But what really gets me about this is even the back three that he plays, right? Last night was Inter's best back three. Those are Inter's three best central defenders. Stefan De Vrij, Bastoni, and Milan Skriniar.
But probably the three best centre-backs that you could find in one club in Serie A as well. You know, we're not talking...
Taken as individuals, yes. Taken as a unit, I have three big, tall people. And I play in a back three with attacking fullbacks. And it's especially bad when it's Hakimi and Perisic, of course. Where every time the ball goes into the corner, these guys have to go and they have to cover the side. Teams that play a back three in modern football... They don't have those types of central defenders. You'll have one dude like that in the middle. And look, Bastoni's a phenomenal player. Skriniar's, you know, he's had some tough times, but these are very good athletes.
Yeah,
but
he's a good player.
I'm sorry, when you're 6'5" and you're in the open field against the Neymar or against the Raheem Sterling, like, you're at a complete disadvantage.
Yeah, good luck with that.
You know, you can't turn him. And this is another failure. That's why Inter weirdly looked better when they have Danilo D'Ambrosio in the back three. Because, you know, at least the guy has that agility. I don't know. I think you need to change things around.
But you remember last season we said that it was almost the title that Juve won. They lost it.
Yeah.
They did. In the way they lost the Europa League as well. And now they look already like having the risk of having exactly the similar season despite the investment that they made in the summer. Like, you know, Hakimi is a 40 million euro player. This is a lot of money.
And he's still there and he's worth it. And he's one of the few potential bright spots if you use him correctly.
But then it already looked like we're in November and they're throwing this season away.
Yeah. And I think that this is something to think. And I'll tell you what, they need to finish top four in Serie A. It's by no means guaranteed. Yeah. Obviously, Milan at the top, you expect Juve will be there, Roma are growing great. Sassuolo, okay, they might not be there at the end of the season, but you still have Napoli, you still have Lazio. You know, there are a number of teams competing there. There's a lot of depth. And if you drop out of that top four, it's going to get really, really ugly. All right, enough Inter, enough Conte, enough destruction of the soul. Jules, how about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
Huge night for Paris Saint-Germain against Leipzig. Job done, Jules?
Job done just because they won, because it was a terrible performance. Leipzig were by far the better side. I don't even know how we won that game, but hey, they just needed the 3 points so badly that they did.
And trust in Tommy.
Exactly.
Trust in Tommy.
Domi van de Beek and Edinson Cavani start for Manchester United, who win handily against Başakşehir. Gab, we will see them. We will see more of them in the near future.
I hope so. Why else did you sign these people? You're paying Cavani an enormous amount of money. I like the fact when Cavani's in there, they have a different look about the way they operate. I think it's more suited, especially in those situations when they can't play in the counter the same way. Van de Beek, you know my view.
So much fluidity that he brings.
Get him in there. Borussia Dortmund beat up Shakhtar 3-0, and guess who scores another two goals? Jules, I'm running out of things to say about him, so you go for it.
12 games in the Champions League, 16 goals. 16 goals, he's 20. I mean, he could have had two more probably on that night. It was incredible. Erling Haaland, what an incredible talent. And a very good win with a lovely free kick as well by Jadon Sancho. Well done for Borussia Dortmund. Some Liverpool players are injured, others are rested. It's a B team for Klopp, and they lose 2-0 at Anfield against Atalanta. Gab, is this a big deal?
I think it is potentially a big deal. Not that you want to read too much into it. And look, I'm not sure. Klopp has to make his decisions. We know about the fixture congestion and whatever else. But what this means now is they have a 2-point lead over Ajax and over Atalanta. You have no margin of error. If you somehow screw up against Ajax, this becomes a really important game. If you screw up, and it's not as if, by the way, all your injured guys are going to be back all of a sudden when you play Ajax. It's next week. So you screw that up, then all of a sudden you're no longer in control of your destiny.
Are a bit, because Ajax will play Atalanta in the last game. So, it's a bit, Liverpool will play Midtjylland.
But you're still depending on results elsewhere.
True, but you think that you beat Michelin and then...
No. I take your point. But, this is not a calculated defeat. And Atalanta, I thought, played really well.
Amazing.
Barcelona arrest Frankie de Jong and Lionel Messi, but come out 4-0 winners against Dinamo Kiev. Jules, what did you learn?
That it was a terrible first half. Like, really, there was nothing.
Mingueza, Pedri,
I know, but Mingueza had a good game for his debut at 21. Alenia didn't do too bad. Pedri was good. We saw Ricky Puig finally playing a little bit. We saw Sergino Dest with his first goal, Conrad de la Fuente as well. I guess it was a good night for that. And they won and they qualified already. And now they can focus on the league where they have to improve their form. Juventus need a late leg goal from Alvaro Morata to be Ferencváros. Gab, why is it so difficult for Pirlo?
It's difficult for him because he doesn't have somebody in midfield who can be a playmaker. He's using Artur in that role. That is not his position. No. Maybe Bentancur would do a bit better. I mean, weirdly, what they need is a Pjanic type. But, of course, the one they had wasn't good when he was there, and he's gone now.
Yeah.
Dybala, very poor. Certainly not in the right frame of mind. And Alvaro Morata with the injury time winner. I think the obvious message is Alvaro has to play.
Yeah.
And look, if you got to go Morata, Cristiano, Kulusevski, another one. I want to see him on the pitch. If you got to go with those guys, go with those guys. Chelsea and Sevilla both wrap up qualification in their group. Jules, do you want to celebrate the handsome World Cup winner who made it all happen?
I always want to. Olivier Giroud played the last 25 minutes and then rose for a lovely, great header. When he smashed the header between the Rennes defender and the crossbar to give Chelsea the win. I think that would boost his confidence. Really good for him, for Chelsea to have won that game, because in the second half, they sort of fell asleep a little bit.
But we agree, they need to play with either Abraham or Giroud. They need to target him.
Definitely. And Timo Werner was shocking again in his finishing. Terrible.
Yeah, but Havertz is back on the bench.
Yeah, that's true. Manchester City also threw winning 1-0 at Olympiacos in a game far too easy for them. But how big is Sergio Aguero coming back and coming on for the last 12 minutes on what was a very emotional night, obviously, for him, considering his relationship with Diego?
No question. And I think this is another thing that Pep will need to think about, because obviously Aguero very, very close to Maradona. In fact,
former son-in-law, yeah.
Yeah, former son-in-law. If Aguero can stay fit, he's a tremendous asset to have. But you don't want to put all your eggs in Aguero's basket. Pep knows that. Pep has said that. Mm. Other people need to step up. You can't use Aguero's return as an excuse. Bayern beat Salzburg 3-1 and are through. But Jules, let's nitpick. Once again, the opposition hammered them on expected goals. And Mark Rocha, not clever.
Well, a stupid red card on Yunusevic for a second yellow when you were already 3-0 up. Crazy for his first start for the team. And you're right, no, you had to make some big saves. Szoboszlai with a huge chance that he missed and blasted over the bar in the first half at 0-0. That could have changed the whole game. And Jesse Marsh, teams played really well again, and they don't get the reward that they deserve when they're so good. But Bayern are a machine, and we know that. Lazio are also through, beating Zenit 3-1. Ciro Immobile gets 2 goals, the first one exceptional as well. All is well at Lazio, right?
Well, Oswald's on the pitch, off the pitch a little bit less so. Luis Alberto having some words.
But they bought a plane and they don't pay the players.
Well, first of all, they have until December 1st to pay the players. It's not good when you have voices of dissent when the team is doing well, which they are in the Champions League. Borussia Mönchengladbach continue to impress. Jules, is Marco Rose's team maybe even better suited to the Champions League?
I think you could be right there, Gab, because they play against teams that maybe don't have the intensity that you can find sometimes in the Bundesliga. I don't know them as well, certainly, your teams in the Bundesliga, and they've played so well in both games against Shakhtar. Pretty incredible. We saw a record number of US players in this round of Champions League. There were 8 in total. Conrad De La Fuente came on to join Serginho Dest. It marked only the second time ever that there were American teammates on the pitch in a Champions League game. We saw Richards with Bayern Munich, for example, the latest one on Wednesday night. Gab, how significant is this?
I think it's hugely significant because these are young players. And look, not all these guys are playing all the time, and doesn't mean Conrad De La Fuente is a second coming. But it means these guys are playing for high-level teams and high-level competitions. They're training against high-level opposition, and they're getting minutes on the pitch. If you're Greg Berhalter, future so bright, you just should be wearing
and
shades.
Where is the 2026 World Cup again?
He goes from bad to worse at Schalke. Jules, tell me more.
What a mess this is. I mean, we had a fight between Naldo, who's the assistant coach, and
a very tall Brazilian.
And very tall Brazilian. And Ibisevic, the 36-year-old striker, who's there on a one-year contract, who's not going to get terminated. We've had Amin Harit and Ben Taleb not being happy, clearly with bad attitudes. Harit being taken off at the weekend and just going straight into the dressing room.
Harit, theoretically, their most gifted player.
Who is so gifted and so talented. It's just it's just not happening for them. The bottom of the table. They've already sacked David Wagner, the first manager in the season. So
major financial issues as well.
Terrible, terrible. We have so much love and praise for Atletico Madrid, Gab, after they beat Barcelona at the weekend. But for sure, they're making life very difficult for themselves in the Champions League with another draw against Lokomotiv Moscow. They couldn't even score.
Yeah, and they have just 5 points. They're 7 points back. I mean, I think it's safe to say they won't be winning the group, but they're cutting this very, very close here. And, of course, I think they have Bayern Munich next, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true.
So, although this Bayern Munich, who knows? I think Cholo has, in terms of numbers, he has the players to compete on both fronts. I still expect him to turn it around, but again, margin for error, getting very, very slim.
Still not there. And Diego Costa now, diagnostic with the VDT,
DVT, deep vein thrombosis.
I think he's only a month out, but it could have been far more serious for him.
Yeah, that's the one we have to wear those flight socks.
Yeah.
Okay, exactly. Not something to joke about, but well soon, Diego.
Definitely.
Now, we all love playing EA Sports FIFA, especially you, Jules, since, as I no doubt you'd remind me, so I'll preempt that. You beat me in the final of the Battle of the League last spring.
Did I? Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, that's true.
Although neither of us was as embarrassing as Augie. But now, Gareth Bale and Zlatan Ibrahimovic want a bigger piece of the action.
And to be fair, I thought it would come earlier. It's been many years that FIFA could use players' name and footage, faces and stuff like that. without really having a deal directly with the players. It's with the clubs, if there's a license to it, and if the player plays for a club, then you can use him. And Ibra tweeted the other day, who did you get permission for to use my name and my face, EA Sports? And I think this is opening a huge debate there. Gareth Bale responded, as you say, Mino Raiola is obviously on the case too, as you could imagine. And I think, there will be a lot of discussion about, do you need to pay players for them to be in your game?
They've been through this previously with previous games and in previous sports. I remember there's a famous case involving Ed O'Bannon. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I just want to keep the game as it is.
Yeah. Gab, I don't want to talk about Marseille because they are terrible in the Champions League. So let me ask you about the manager, André Villas-Boas. He would like every team in the world to retire the number 10 from their squad, from their roster. No one would never wear the number 10 again. Do you think that's fair, or is it just to deflect the attention of yet another disastrous night from him and from Marseille?
I mean...
Or both?
Look, Diego is el 10 and whatever. He wore number 10. Many other great players also wore number 10. For me, I like the notion of retiring shirt numbers. You know, I like the fact that nobody's worn Franco Baresi's number at Milan, for example.
Or the 10 at Napoli either.
Or the 10 at Napoli, yeah. I mean, I think that is a good way to honor past players. But, you know, retiring because of Diego Maradona, well, what about Pelé? What about, you know, can Lionel Messi say that, hey, I did a few things in football too with this number 10 on my back? Like,
and also they're inspiring young players and players to wear the number 10. You want to wear the number 10 because that was Diego's number. Why would you take that away from aspiring football players, whatever level as a professional game? This is crazy.
What I would like to see is maybe the teams that Diego played for saying, all right, let's give up the 10, you know, including maybe Argentina, you know, or whatever. Or Messi might feel I'm honoring the shirt by wearing this 10. Like, I mean, there's better ways. Yeah, I appreciate the sentiment, AVB, but...
But you were bad, and you lost again, by the way.
Stop it. Right, that's all we've got time for on this melancholy Thursday. But we'll be back on Monday. So until then, love the game, love yourself, love your neighbor. Ciao, Diego.